Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. This is Colin Miller, one of your co-hosts on the Undisclosed Podcast. As always, I am joined by my co-host and partner in crime, Rabia Chowdhury. So, Rabia, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you, Colin?
I'm doing well. And we are also, as always this season, joined by Jennifer Leahy, a research and investigative assistant, working with us all the way back to the Jason Carroll series. And so, Jen, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Colin. Thanks.
Yeah. So today we'll be talking about all things episode 11 of the Patricia Rohr series as we wrap it up, loose ends. And so my first question today, and I'll start with you, Jen, how going into this series and starting to work on Patty's case, how has that lined up with and maybe differed from how you're feeling on the back end of it?
I mean, I think throughout there's just been, for me, I mean, there's so much to process. I feel like I could spend a year, you know, just, I mean, people have obviously spent multiple years just full time looking through things. But I really found, listening to this last episode, some hope, you know, with Rabia talking about, you know, options to pursue. And, you know, I don't come from a legal background, so I'm really interested to learn more about what's next.
Yeah. And Rabia, for you, from when you first heard about this case and started looking into it, how is that the same as or different from how you're feeling now on the back end of this series?
I'm actually strangely feeling more hopeful because when I went in, look, this case has gone through a lot of different advocates before it got to us, right? It's gone through Judges for Justice. I mean, you've got Tammy, it's gone through so many three post convictions. It's gone through so much. And it was like, man, what's left to try, right? But there still is a lot more that can be done in this case. I mean, Innocence Clinic at Georgetown sent it to us. And, you know, so that's the thing is that when we're considering what cases to take, the question is always like, is there anything we can do? Now, we went into this hoping we could find some new evidence, find some kind of appealable issue, some reversible error, something. We did not, but it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It could be in further forensic testing. It could be in the files that the state refuses to turn over. It could be in stuff that's been buried. But this could just come down to getting all of this in front of a federal court, including some of the new evidence that the court hasn't seen and getting their perspective on it.
And speaking of evidence that the courts haven't seen, Rabia, a good chunk of the start of this episode is about your quest to track down Fonda Eggers. Again, listeners, this is the distant relative of Patty's who took it upon herself to do surveillance essentially the week when Patty is supposedly in Pennsylvania committing this crime. And Robbie, I mean, how do you feel if Fonda Eggers is tracked down and she's willing to talk and write an affidavit saying, I watched or someone watched every day that week and Patty was there every day. I mean, is that enough in your mind to be a Brady violation because that was turned over and not disclosed to the defense? Or is that not enough for a Brady violation in your mind?
I think it absolutely is enough for a Brady violation. I mean, but the thing is this, I mean, again, the court would weigh a Brady violation against here's the thing, Colin. Actually, I'm not sure about this. Mm-hmm. Does the court weigh the Brady violation against what else the jury has heard? In that case, absolutely yes. I think this could get her a new trial. Or is the court going to take into consideration subsequent DNA tests that, you know, we don't even believe are accurate, done years or dozens of years later? So how does the court, I think the court looks at the weight of this Brady versus what the jury heard, not what happened later, right?
And so to break that down for listeners, if Patty goes back into state court and claims this is a newly uncovered Brady violation, the court is going to look at what Fonda Eggers has to say and compare it solely against the record as it existed at trial. If Patty were trying to go into federal court and using the actual innocence bootstrap, then the court can look beyond the trial record to all of the evidence, including the new DNA evidence. And so, Rabia, a regular state Brady claim, just the trial record, federal court, actual innocence, all the evidence that's existed.
Yeah. I mean, I think it all comes down to whether or not they're able to prove that the evidence is the forensic DNA testing is not reliable, right? Mm-hmm. That like something went deeply wrong here. The hairs are switched or something. By the way, you know, in the last episode, I referred to the prosecutor who has been in touch with us and who is refuses to let go of this case, which I am fascinated by. The only other time I've ever seen anything like this, by the way, is there was that guy from the Making a Murderer case, right? Like he just kept, he was invested forever as well. I've never seen anybody do this and I don't understand why this is going on and on. But anyhow, I got another email from him and I want to read, I'm not going to read all of it, but I want to read something he says, in particularly about Eggers. Mm-hmm. This is what he said. Because I said to him, I'm not in a court of law. I'm having private conversations with him. I'm like, how are you okay as somebody, and by the way, his politics are very progressive. How are you as somebody who's such a progressive political person, an officer of the court, okay with the fact that, you know, Patty was deprived of alibi witnesses, like, you know, and these are Brady violations. And he's like, well, first of all, no court has ever found Brady in this case. But he also says, now he's listening to every single thing we do. He's going to listen to this. He goes, in regard to Eggers and Rouse, I have no knowledge of the reports to which you're referring. Now, I don't know if that he means, I have no idea what you're talking about. If you're listening to our podcast, sir, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And if you have no knowledge of the reports, then maybe you should have gone and spoken to Eggers and they're like, did you give those reports to Detective Roberson of, you know, you need to, why aren't you figuring out whether something went wrong here? Why don't you care enough? So if you have no knowledge, and same thing with Rouse, who is, I mean, I want to ask this gentleman, who told the defense team that Rouse couldn't make it because there's a death in the family? Was that the detective or is that somebody from the prosecutor's team? Who did that? How did that information get to the defense? Where did it come from? And then once again, the same detective, go and ask him, hey, dude, like, did you go to this guy's house and ask him to like sign away and tell him he didn't need to appear in court? I mean, you just having no knowledge is not sufficient. If you are an officer of the court and you care about the truth, do some diligence, put in some work and figure the shit out.
And this, frankly, Rabia, could be a solution to this that would appease all parties in the sense of if Fonda Eggers turned this over to the detective and that was never disclosed to this prosecutor.
Right.
And he's in the dark. That's still a Brady violation if law enforcement has it, but not the prosecutor. And that's a way where prosecution can say, we never got this. Defense can say, we never got this. And that could be a Brady violation without having to show that the prosecution.
And he says in this email, like, you're accusing me of Brady. I'm saying, no, I don't know where the Brady is, but something went wrong. And we know for sure that this detective was involved in two witnesses, not basically, or you know, their alibis not being available for Patty's defense.
Right. And speaking of the alibi and whether it's Leroy Rouse and the grain or it is Fonda Eggers and her surveillance of Patty. We started this series in the first episode or two talking about how that very first night we have Andy calling Patty's mother's number, phone number, because he supposedly doesn't have Patty's phone number. But my understanding, Rabia and Jen, is that Andy did in fact have Patty's phone number all along. Am I correct on that?
Okay, so I was having a conversation with Patty last week and we were talking about this and she's like, I should have just called him back that night. She's like, I kept thinking, why didn't he call me? He has my number. He'd mailed her many, many cards and she finally responded and said, this is my number. He called her. And then that's when they started communicating. They both had each other's number. She's like, the night that he called my mother, she's like, he had my number. I don't know why he didn't call me. It didn't really occur to me. She was like, you know, maybe because, you know, last time she had called, the wife hung up on her. So maybe it was that kind of thing. So he's like, I don't want to call her directly. Right. But she kind of was like, that was weird because he does have my number.
Right.
But that's why she thought that maybe he didn't call her because Joe didn't want that.
Got it. All right. Well, and then returning to the topic of the DA in this case, one of the prosecutors, Jen, who's been in communication, et cetera. One of those topics that's been discussed back and forth is the question of paternity and whether it's been conclusively proven that Andy is, in fact, Alex's father, which, of course, Jen, I think, as you noted in the exchange, is separate from the question of what Andy might have known or thought at the time that Joe disappeared. But, Jen, what did you find in your review of the records regarding paternity in this case?
But let me, before Jen gets to that, I just want to say the reason we're addressing this is because this prosecutor has emailed me a couple of things that he believes are inaccuracies in our reporting. Mm-hmm. One of them is this. He's like, you accurately reported that there's no paternity, there's no, you know, definitive paternity testing. But he's like, it was definitely, and in the Alex was Andy's son, and that was testified to, and there's a lab report. And so Jen has looked up that information. And Jen, tell us what you found there.
Yeah, so I looked up both the trial testimony that was being referred to as well as the associated lab report. And what I am seeing is that basically they were looking, they had swabbed things and were testing against, I think it was Jensen, Alex, Andy, and Joe. And I'll just quote from it. In addition, the source of specimen K5, who was Andy, cannot be excluded as being the father of the source of specimen K3, Alex. So, like, yeah, he can't be excluded. And then when you go to Deadman's testimony that's associated with that report, because that report was one of the trial exhibits, Deadman is asked, did you do any comparison with the blood that you had from Andrew Katrinak and the spleen you had from Alex Katrinak in regard to what we could call basically a paternity type comparison? Yes, I did. And what did you find? The results obtained from Andrew indicated that his results were consistent with him being the father of Alex. Given the results obtained from Alex's mother and Alex's result, we then know which marker that each of the tests has to come from the father. And in fact, Andrew was capable of contributing the marker for each of the 6 tests that were run, which matches up with the report that I looked at. Mm-hmm. So basically, I think he's saying he's not, my interpretation of it, and the lab report says it, he can't be excluded, right? Like the markers, mm-hmm. he is capable of contributing. But in looking more into paternity testing, even at that time, I mean, like by then they were able to do PCR testing and test on way more markers, you know? So it sounds like, I mean, like regardless, it doesn't, you know, well, we already went over whether it's relevant in this case, whether he factually was or not. But my understanding is Deadman saying he can't be excluded. He, you know, it might be very likely it is. I'm not a geneticist. Right. I don't know like how significant those 6 markers are. I know some of them are more rare than others, you know, like but this test, looking at it in the context, I think it was trying to like tease apart multiple DNA profiles. And I don't think I don't see it's being stated as being run specifically for paternity. You know, uh-huh. It's just that they're like noting, oh, and this guy right. can't be excluded as the father of this other, you know, profile. So,
and also, Jen, you were talking, you shared information with me about like what it actually takes to have definitive paternity results.
And yeah, nowadays, like they're, you know, it's right. PCR, and I'd have to look and see because I don't believe this was even PCR. Again, I think it was like an earlier form of, you know, genetic testing. But yeah, I mean, you would need like, I think it's 15 or 16 markers to match for like 99%, you know, and then depending, you know, like, and if you have less than a certain amount of non-matching, but this doesn't even look like that was the type of test that was run.
Right.
So what do you kind of think about this claim that, Jen, just given your look into this, that is it just means that Andy cannot be excluded, but it doesn't mean he definitely is Alex's father?
Yeah, I mean, and that's, you know, you would love some more detail in the report, right? Because cannot be excluded could mean we can exclude 90% of the population. It could also mean we can exclude 30% of the population. So we just need some more detail there right. to be able to say whether right. this is really significant.
Well, look, my response to him was this. You know, I was like, whether or not, I was like, the paternity report happened, or these tests happened like later, right? Like, in terms of the mens rea of at the time of the crime, if it was Alec, if it was Andy thinking maybe this had something to do with Andy being his child or not, we have no idea. Hmm? But at the time, he wouldn't have known, right? Right. This is a man who his entire life has not been able to father a child, and suddenly he's got a baby. And, you know, the point is, like, whether or not later it was established, even if it was definitely established, it has nothing to do with, at the time of the crime, whether or not Andy might have been suspected whether he was the father.
Right.
The other thing that he raised also was another correction he wanted us to make. And he says he has lots more, but also he's very upset because he thinks I'm super biased. Okay, me and like so many other innocence people, experts who've looked at this, but he says that we misreported that her fingernails were not scraped, the victim's, Joanne's. And I think that's true. I think we did say that the scrapings weren't taken. Well, they were by the FBI. However, this is what I found. And unless I'm missing something. There's a report from May 6, 1996 from the FBI that says, you know, it's just listing the specimens. And one of the specimens is a Q3 fingernail scraping.
That's the one that was found on her chest that ties in with the item number 5.
So this is, oh, these are not from her fingernails.
Yeah, that's what I was looking into. And I went back and searched and they did. And then like you look at the later, I think, testing from 2008 and they have that item number tied to Q3.
That's what I was thinking. When I saw the Q3, I was like, and to be honest, I had very little time to like look into this because I just looked at this email yesterday and I was like, I got to quickly look at this. Okay. And I was like, Q3 is one of the samples that we already talked about.
Exactly. Q3, the report that he referred back to, I went and looked at, and it's talking about Q3. And then I traced it to like even later testing. And it appeared to be scraped or other, you know, stuff removed from it. So that is correct. The only problem is that's not her nail.
It's not her fingernails.
And her fingernails, I have found documentation of, they were clipped. Her right hand was clipped, 4 fingernails. Mm-hmm. And then they later identified a nail, which they believed was her missing pinky nail, you know. Those are clipped. Those are saved. It looked like they were like microscopically looked at. You know, I found the reports where he's noting like handwritten, you know, like he's talking about.
Was it Jensen or Dezina?
I believe I honestly have to look again. I don't want to be wrong about that. But I have seen notes that, you know, a person at a lab is, you know, they have the saved fingernail clippings and they've looked at them. But I haven't been able to find where those nails, her actual fingernails, were then scraped or otherwise, you know, sent to be tested.
Yeah, I don't. I have never seen a lab report in which they were sent to the FBI lab to be actually tested for.
Yeah, the one that we're referring to is the fingernail that was found on her that was identified as not matching with the others.
Okay. Well, hopefully that satisfies the prosecutor. And he has, I think, lots of other things to say as well. So, I mean, maybe in a future addendum, we can circle back to this and keep this going. I mean, I got questions too, sir. So,
One of those questions, Rabia, is we noted in this episode, there were at least two itches we weren't able to scratch in this series. One of them being the gunshots the neighbor heard the night before. And to remind listeners, the only evidence that Joe was alive on the day she supposedly disappeared is Andy's accounting and then the phone call that his mother allegedly made to Joe that day. And so I'm going to read, this is a report of patrolman Kevin M. Smith filed on December 16th, 1994 at 1950 hours. On the above date and time, this officer, along with Sergeant John Lackett, spoke with John Bogert, gives the address. Bogert related to us that at 3:20 hours this date, in other words, 3:20 in the morning, he awakened in his bedroom, which is along the front side of his bedroom, when he heard what he says were gunshots. He stated that he heard the shots close together, then 2 single gunshots approximately 30 seconds apart. At the time, he did not report the incident, but after learning of the incident at 740 Front Street, he felt he needed to report the incident, advised Bogart info be forwarded to the detective, and he would be in contact as soon as possible. So my first question, Jenna Ravia, is there any evidence there was follow-up on this?
Okay, first of all, it's a little context. This guy lives right next door to them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's that. Here's the thing. This report is taken on December 16th. That's a day after Joe is reported missing. He says, and it says, at 3:20 hours this date, which means 3:20 a.m. in the middle of the night, which would have been the night between the 15th and the 16th. So there's that, right? Unless the report is just poorly written, and what they mean when they say this date, they're referring to the relevant date of her disappearance. That's unclear from this. Uh-huh. But I think they meant the night between the 15th and the 16th.
I think because, so.
Yeah, I think
which
so
is why too. He would report it after learning of the incident.
Right. Yeah. So, and I think because of that, they kind of didn't follow up. I didn't see anything in terms of any more questioning on this at all. And it could be because if he thought he heard something in the middle of the night, or he said, this is what he said. He said, actually, maybe there was one more report that had more of a narrative. He said that he always wakes up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom one time. He woke up in the middle of the night and he looked at the clock. And that's when he heard the gunshots. He just happened to look at the clock and it was like 3:20. Like, he remembered the time. He noted the time exactly. And he heard what he thought were three shots, I think. But I think because of the date, they just kind of like didn't really take it seriously, because the date doesn't, if he had said it happened the night before that, then maybe they would have taken it. But I don't know. I mean, like, but also, you know, they searched the house. Apparently they didn't find anything, but I do want to talk about that search. Okay. We know the police searched Andy's home, but they did not search it for a couple of days. Okay. There's that. So he has plenty of time to do any kind of cleanup he needs to. The second thing is this: Sarah Kaelin and I visited the house, and the people who lived there were lovely enough to let us. They're like, oh yeah, we totally know what this crime. Other people have been here to look at the house. We went through the house to the basement, actually. When we were in the basement, Sarah discovered a subcellar. And this is something that I have not seen in any of the reports. Like, none of the reports mention the basement. They don't mention a subcellar. Now, I would not have even known it was there. It was really dark. It's in a corner. And Sarah was just like, what is this over here? It looked like a big piece of plywood or wood or something. She lifts it up and it's steps going down into a subcellar. It's not a big space, maybe 10 by 10 room. And she goes down there and she's like, oh my God, has anybody been in here? And I said, I don't know. We don't know if the dogs they use, the SAR dogs they use, ever went to the subcellar. There is literally no mention of it. So we don't even know if the police discovered that thing existed.
Yeah.
So even though there was a search, would that search have been sufficient if they missed a subcellar and they didn't do it for 2 days? Probably not.
Speaking of the dog, this is one thing I was actually happened to be coming across recently that it's been driving me crazy. I don't know if you remember in the report where it shows like the dog goes to like the attic.
Right.
They said, you know, the dog goes to this. They never say the dog goes to the first floor. The dog's in the cellar. The dog's in the attic. The dog's in the second floor. And then the dog goes outside. I don't know if it's just an omission in the record. Like, how could you not search the main place of residence?
Right.
Although, honestly, I don't know what the dog was supposed to detect on. Was it a cadaver dog, or was it like a live, you know, like a, was it looking for the scent of, or one or both of the individuals? It doesn't have that noted in the report that I have access to.
It's a really brief report.
Yeah.
But it's very, like, it's noticeable. It goes from like the top of the house, and then somehow the first floor is not noted as the dog going into, which I'm very perplexed by.
Because it's such a crappy report in terms of the detailing of it. It could just be like an omission. The dog,
right?
Unless the dog jumped a floor. I mean, the dog had to necessarily go through, but you know,
they get a separate entrance, so not necessarily.
To get to the attic? Yeah, I guess so. But
the attic, and then because they have a unit above them, right?
Yeah, right, on the right. First That's floor, what I'm saying. The second floor and the attic would have been connected, I'm guessing. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But I mean, like, I guess maybe they were like, what's the point of even checking? Of course she's on the main floor, right? They're just trying to detect whoever her scent can pick up. When he goes outside, the dog does detect on a couple of bushes.
Yeah. So I guess at that point, they probably weren't using a cadaver dog. They were using somebody looking for them.
Yeah.
Who knows?
And so in this episode of Loose Ends, we have the other loose end that was referenced by Rabia, and that is the mysterious flower petals, the floral petals found in the sole of Joe's boots at a time and place they didn't belong. So this is forensic botany. And so, Rabia, what can you briefly tell the listeners about these floral petals?
Very, very little, because that's what there is in the reports. It's kind of noted as an afterthought. It seems like, you know, it's noted by, I think by the medical examiner that this exists, that they collected this from her boots.
Right.
I have not seen any reports of them trying to identify the floral material, but it looked like there were some petals, and I think they were white, if I remember correctly. Jen, do you remember reading that or not?
I don't remember a color noted. I remember seeing, it might have been a handwritten note that speculated about what type of flowers they would be. The only one that sticks in my mind is like, maybe it's an aster, but it was very like, speculative. It wasn't like these had been identified. And in fact, there was a number of possible flowers. It wasn't just one. So,
oh, but you know what? I think the note you're talking about was written, it might have been written by Patty's defense team, because a lot of the documents we have handwritten notes written on them that are actually written by either Patty or her defense counsel, like somebody on the defense team, which can get a little confused, unless you actually looked at forensic handwritten, like notes from a forensic lab with handwritten notes or something. I don't know.
I think it was, but again, I'd have to go back and find it. It was quite a while ago that I looked at it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think there could be some significance to them. At the same time, it's like she walks through the neighborhood a lot. She could have picked it up. I mean, this is a season that's wet and muddy. Her boots could have, it would be hard to really, you couldn't date when she picked it up, right? Like when, how long that thing has been stuck in her boot, and, you know, it could have been there for a long time, or it could have just been fresh, because, you know, I also think about the fact that it seems Joe was very fastidious. I can't imagine her,
right,
like going into her home and keeping her boots dirty. Like if she had gotten them dirty and muddy, like she would have cleaned them and then worn them again. I don't think she would have continued to, but I don't know. But that kind of has, the only reason that has like kind of raised some eyebrows with some folks who've looked at this case, and is because there is a related party to the case, and that is the woman that Andy subsequently marries, Teresa Bonchini. Her family business was a nursery. And so folks are like, oh, is there some connection there? But let's say it was a nursery. Again, it's the same season, right? Like, what does that mean? Does that mean Joe went to the nursery? Or like, it's just a weird loose end, just like we've said. Now, all these years later, I mean, like, if that stuff still exists, I don't know. What do you think, Colin? Do you think it'd be worth asking for some kind of testing on it, or trying to identify it? I feel like all these years later, it'd be useless.
I mean, it depends on how it's been preserved. But I mean, if it's been preserved enough to test, I think certainly couldn't hurt.
To just try to identify what kind of species it was, and right, where it would have been.
You're right, exactly.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. All right, we have some SpeakPipe messages, and the first of these is going to relate to Leroy Rouse, we mentioned earlier in the addendum, and so this is the message by Kelly.
Hi, this is Kelly. I had a question about the timing and evidence of the grain purchase. My recollection is that Patty went to court early, like a Monday in December, and was ordered to start keeping track of her grain purchases, and in particular, keeping her receipts. Then her alibi was that Thursday she was purchasing grain. Was there no receipt for that grain purchase? Thanks.
Okay, that's a great question. Yeah. She was required by the court, and which, I mean, that she was ordered by the court literally just days before this happened, to keep the grain receipts in case they were ever checked. I'm assuming she kept the grain receipt until it was checked by, the thing is, we've not been able to get any records of like that entire investigation, and like notes or reports from a probation officer, a parole officer. It was a probation officer, I think. To see like when he checked it, but she was allowed to dispose of them once she showed them. So, I mean, I actually have not asked Patty that question directly, but my understanding is that maybe Tammy referred to it in the book. I can't remember, that she just, once she would produce the receipts, she would just then just get rid of them.
Right. So my question from that would be, can we track down either the probation or the parole officer? Because yeah, I mean, ostensibly that officer isn't going to take Patty's word for it. They're going to check the receipts. And if that person were willing to do an affidavit saying, I checked it with her after a month or a few weeks, and I made sure each week she had a receipt for a grain purchase, I mean, that's a pretty strong alibi in my mind.
I don't think we were able to identify the officer. There was another gentleman referred to in Fonda Egger's report, and actually we spoke to him. But I don't think he was the one in charge of looking at the receipts. And I don't think anywhere in the very limited like notes that we have that I saw a name. Jen, do you remember seeing a name?
I remember seeing a name, but I don't know if it was the name, you know. Right. Maybe it'd be worth asking if she remembered. I remember calling, you know, like animal control, like trying to track down, and they didn't have, you know, there was nothing they could offer me at the time. Yeah, I mean, maybe if Patty happens to remember exactly who, but I have not had luck from getting records from Davidson County.
I mean, like, overall, I mean, could you imagine if she didn't have a receipt for that very first week for a grain purchase? I mean, obviously that's going to ring alarm bells, but the absence of anything happening to Patty kind of proves that she showed a receipt to the officer, in my mind.
Right. But what date it was, that's, right. You know, did they note that, and would they still have those records?
Yeah. I mean, this is kind of like, I remember when, Colin, you went through that incredible exercise of like with Adnan's case. Yeah. Of narrowing like the day that he was probably seen after school, like with a car issue. Remember all that? You went through this whole exercise, like, and I feel like it's kind of like that here too, where it's like you've got Leora Rouse saying that she came in on Thursdays and, you know, and Saturdays. Patty from day one is saying, I was there. This is the guy, you know, she's provided this as an alibi. But it is weird that there's no mention of a receipt at that time, because why didn't she could have been like, I had a receipt, I showed it to my officer, right? Like, that would have been great,
right?
So actually I'll ask her. I'll ask her.
Well, and that's the question too, is if Patty recalls, it might be that she gave the copies of the receipts to the officer and that's the reason she doesn't have them anymore.
That's true. But yeah, you know, the other thing is this, because look, all we have in terms of what Patty said to the police is what's written in the police reports,
right?
And they are not always accurate. You know, I mean, we referred to a passage from one of the reports that says Patty admits calling him Andy on the 12th. No, she doesn't. She actually never admitted that. And phone records show they don't. So who knows? Maybe Patty said, by the way, I showed the animal control officer, the parole officer, whoever it was, like the receipt, and he has them. And that never made it as far as the report. That is, frankly, I mean, anything's possible, right? But she's not saying that she didn't. I mean, she's asserting that this is exactly what happened on that day. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I'm going to ask her. I'll ask her. And you know what? And maybe next week's whatever, you know, at some point we'll circle back to it. Keep listening.
All right. Our next SpeakPipe message is from Jenny. And it's a topic that's especially pertinent to me as a professor about to go back into the classroom, because there's these two schools of thoughts in the classroom and the courtroom. And so, Rabia, if we can cue up Jenny's message.
Hi, my name is Jenny. I'm calling from Dallas. I have often wondered if jurors were allowed to take notes during cases, and I did hear that they were not allowed to take notes in the Patty Rohr case, and that is mind-blowing to me. Can you speak about why judges do or don't allow note-taking? And if they don't, do the jurors get to read the transcripts as each night or each day? Thanks. I love what you guys do. Thanks a lot.
You take this one, Colin.
What do we know in this case?
They were not.
Was it ever on the record about whether the jurors were allowed to take notes or not?
They weren't.
They were not.
They were not allowed to take notes. Schools of thought being, some judges think if jurors are taking notes, they're more engaged, they're more active, they can look back at their notes during deliberations. Great, allow them to do it. Other judges, apparently like the judge in this case, say they're not paying attention as much if they're taking notes. They're not observing the demeanor of the witnesses. What they write could be inaccurate. They're trying to piece it together when they're in the deliberations room, which of course is what students are doing when they're studying for exams. And so I'm a huge advocate for jurors being able to take notes, but Jen, what's your thought about whether jurors should be able to take notes or not?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm going to defer to people that have actually been in courtrooms. But me personally, I'm just, you know, if I were on the jury, I can't imagine not being able to take notes. I mean, I think it depends on learning styles, too, and everything. But just to keep everything straight, especially when you look at these transcripts, like the sheer volume of everything, I feel like otherwise you're just going to remember, you know, like bits and pieces. And I think they were allowed to request things to look back on. But even that, I mean, the fact that they came back with the decision so quickly, like, I'm not sure how much they could have requested to, you know.
And that's another two schools of thought. If the jurors can request a transcript of a witness's testimony, it's up to the judge's discretion about whether to give it to them or not.
Right. But then how do you even remember who to ask, you know?
Right.
Or what to ask for a trial of this size? Like, I can't emphasize just how I mean, just even reading some of the, you know, the really detailed scientific stuff, like how you would keep that straight if you couldn't have a visual. At least I would really struggle to understand it. And
I mean, you know, I feel conflicted about this because I know if I'm watching something, like, for example, when I first started looking at this case, one of the first things I did was watch the Judges for Justice docuseries on YouTube. And I took notes. I took notes as I'm watching it, just to get a lay of the land of the case. And I had to keep pausing to take notes. If that thing continuously played as I'm taking notes, I definitely would have missed things that are actually happening in front of me. I had to pause it, I'd write it down, then I'd start again, right? And so I would be that person that if I'm taking notes while things are unfolding in front of me, I'm absolutely going to miss stuff as it's happening. So I don't know what the fix is. Maybe the fix is at the end of the day, you know, a transcript is provided. I don't know if that's something, I don't know what is, but I guess it also depends on like everybody's brains work differently. But I do think that giving jurors the option is a good idea, and maybe counseling them and saying, look, if you're going to miss what's happening, then you got to be, you know, maybe brief in your note taking. I don't know. I don't know what the fix is. What do you think, Colin?
I mean, that's completely my fix, which is to say, okay, well, some judges allow note taking, fine. Those who don't, and I mean, I do this in my own class. I record all my classes.
Right, right.
And so if it's something where, especially in a seminar, I want class discussion and engagement, okay, no notes during this discussion. If you want to go back, you can watch the recording. So
that is
in cases with no note taking, yep, allow the jurors to see the transcripts during deliberation.
Yeah,
that would be great. If I knew that I had like a written record that I wasn't gonna have to like ask for piece by piece,
or an actual video or audio, that would be even better.
Yeah, even better. Yeah,
yeah. Because look, if we have to read these transcripts over and these forensic reports over and over and over to try to get our heads around them, imagine trying to understand all that information and even piece it together, either in a timeline or however, like in whatever kind of map in your head as it's happening in front of it's really hard. It's really hard.
Investigating wrongful conviction cases can mean facing hard questions and heavy emotions. Talkspace makes support easier to reach with licensed therapists and nurse practitioners across all 50 states. Choose therapy through live chat, video, or audio sessions and fit care into a busy routine. Plans start at $69 per week, and most insured members pay $0. If the match does not feel right, switching providers costs nothing extra. Support is available for individuals, teens, and couples. Taking care of mental health can be one steady step when life feels difficult to sort through. Talkspace is in network with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off of your first month when you go to Talkspace.com and enter promo code SPACE80. That's SPACE80. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com.
All right, our next speak pipe is from Amy, and it's about how much Andy's financial status was investigated in this case.
Hi, my name is Amy Henderson, and I'm a longtime listener of the podcast. I've been listening since the first season and absolutely love the work that you guys do. My question was about whether or not Andy's financial past was really looked at enough during the investigation, and whether or not there was any type of forensic accounting, whether or not Patty's defense team brought this up at all during trial. I know that he had been running an all cash business and kind of, you know, squirreling the money away in the house, keeping it there rather than in a bank account because he was trying to avoid paying what he owed the IRS in a back tax judgment, which kind of raised a lot of red flags for me, not sure what was going on with that. And then also had been listening to Mal's book, Convenient Suspect, and noticed that, you know, she spoke in there about him also lying to Patty and saying that he was paying on the house that she allowed him to live in, but he wasn't. And she didn't know that until it was foreclosed on. And then even afterwards, he went on and put his phone number at the Front Street house in her name, long after they were broken up, didn't tell her. And that was still in her name when Joe went missing. Just how that was all very bizarre, raised a lot of red flags for me. He doesn't seem to think that maybe rules apply to him, and just wondering what was going on with the financials. It just seems like there's something really missing.
Yeah. So our listeners obviously heard, but how much did the jurors hear?
Yeah. I'm trying to remember. I don't think it was brought up in front of the jury at all.
No, they heard some of it.
What do they hear?
Well, Andy, sorry. I would have loved to have been pushed, you know, on even more. But they heard that he had financial difficulties. Yeah. I don't remember exactly who asked what, but I know that like back taxes, you know, were sort of brought up. I don't think they got into the nitty gritty of it. I am pretty sure actually the phone was brought up, but.
Mm-hmm.
But the house.
Way he was allowed to describe it was like made from what I remember was it sounds like he kind of implied that, you know, it was with Patty's okay that he did this phone thing. Cause I think they were asking about it more in the context of like, wouldn't Joanne have been upset about getting a phone bill in this other woman's name, you know? And so that I do remember coming up in the testimony, but I'm not sure how much it was really like examined, you know. And then other stuff that like we know from the record that like didn't like some credit card applications come in Patty's name.
Yeah, for years after Andy actually sold the house, for years later, and this is something Margaret Sneary, that journalist who was at the trial, found out, that she went and spoke to the woman who lived at that address. Then afterwards, the woman's like, we still get credit card applications in Patty's name. And Patty hadn't been there in a long time.
She'd never lived there.
Right. Oh, you're right. She had actually never lived there. She was there briefly, but she hadn't lived in the town in a long time. Amy asked specifically about forensic accounting. I don't think, as I'm trying to remember, like in the police investigative reports, I don't think there was actually what kind of accounting could be done with a guy who's completely off the grid? I don't know.
Right. Yeah, I can see some FBI reports with, I think they're running credit checks, but unfortunately the copy I have, they're all like
blacked out,
redacted.
Yeah.
We all have the same copy.
Amy has a second speak pipe with a timing, you might call it a coincidence or not. And so if we can listen to this second speak pipe message by Amy.
Hi, this is Amy Henderson again, part two, sorry. Still with a question about Andy's finances. Also noticed from the book that, you know, when he and Joe were talking about moving out to Colorado, they were working with the realtor and, you know, were trying to explain their situation, that, you know, he did not have good credit and that because of that, they would need to find a parcel of land that was sold by owner and someone who was willing to carry the mortgage themselves. And obviously that would be challenging to do, but it sounds like their realtor did find someone and, you know, let them know that. And all of a sudden it kind of switched from being excited to moving into not moving. And something that really stuck out to me is that the day that they were supposed to give like the final decision, they had the final say on whether or not they could apply for that land, was the day that Joe went missing. And I just thought, is that a coincidence? I don't know. I just have so many questions about what was really going on with Andy during that time about finances, what Joan knew or didn't know. Were they fighting about it? Had she threatened to divorce him and, you know, take money from him, do a forensic accounting? I don't know. I have so many questions about that. Really, really sticks out to me. Okay. Thanks so much. Appreciate you guys.
I have two thoughts that I'll open the floor for you two to respond. My first thought being, one, a decision as big as that, whether to buy this land in Colorado and move, would be extraordinarily stressful. And two, if this was D-Day, decision day, and Andy's finances were not what he held them out to be, and he finally had to come clean and say what his finances were, there could be a fallout from that. And so those are my two thoughts. Jen, I'll start with you. What are your thoughts about the timing of this decision and Joe disappearing?
Yeah, no, I am with you, Colin. I'm with you, Amy. I've had very similar thoughts. It's an interesting date. And yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, we heard from Patty saying like she wasn't aware of his financial situation for a while. And so Joe may very well have not been aware of the full extent of it, you know, especially when you see these in the records, the conversations with the realtor and how much they were looking to spend and everything. And I mean, I don't know their finances. I don't know what their plan was for buying this land in the first place, but I'm like, how are they going to swing it?
Yeah.
You know, so maybe they had some real conversations.
Yeah. Robbie, what are your thoughts about the timing of this?
I mean, listen, I've known people like this. I've known men like this who their wives have no idea what's actually happening under the surface, like financially, because there's a lot of like shame around it. I mean, clearly mm-hmm. this is, Andy is not a young man. Andy is like, you know what I mean? He's lived his entire adult life. It seems like not financially responsible, right? Responsibly. His father's always like, you know, coming to his rescue. His credit sucks. He won't even open a bank account. The IRS, like all these things, right? Like this is a lifetime of these patterns. And I've also seen where that kind of stuff, the stress from hiding it and it finally coming out, or you having to account for it, like in a big decision like this, can make somebody snap or spiral in other ways or just cause fights. I think the timing is weird, odd, interesting. And I always thought the same thing, that every time this, you know, this conversation came up and they went out to Colorado, and I'm like, how are you going to pay for it? I wasn't sure. Mm-hmm. Maybe the idea was that Joe would go back to work and they would go in together. And you know, that's why they wanted like owner financing. Maybe the father was going to help, you know.
Yeah.
They must have had, because it also feels like if it was not a doable thing, would he even spend money? Would Andy even spend money taking his wife out there a number of times, right? Like that costs money too. I don't know.
Keep the charade up as long as you can sometimes, right? To your point about many men not wanting to reveal their true financial status. Yeah. And so to complete the trilogy for Amy Henderson, we have a message, not a speak pipe, that I'll read, which I find interesting and listeners might find interesting. So Amy writes, do you think Patty would have benefited from a bench trial? In other words, trial with a judge, not a jury. Her lawyers failed her in so many ways. I think it was unethical of them to take on her case, not bring on another attorney who actually had death penalty experience. I also wonder if she would have been better served by a co-ed defense team, especially given the blatant misogyny at play. What are your thoughts? And so my starting thought is, I always teach my students the three types of defendants who want a bench trial. Those charged with child sex crimes, a person of color in a district where their jury is likely not to have people of color on it, and the so-called black widow, a woman accused of being a woman scorned in however many ways and taking out her wrath. And so I certainly think that Patty would have benefited from a bench trial here as opposed to a jury trial. But what are your thoughts first, Rabia?
I mean, I just don't know. I always feel like that gives you one shot versus 12 shots.
True.
Right? And in this case, we had somebody who was not convinced of her guilt. If that juror number 9 had made it to the verdict, they would have had a hung jury. So I don't know. And you know, my review of the record is that it didn't seem like the judge was super friendly to the defense.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I guess, and maybe that's another call that the attorneys have to make, is depends on the judge, right? Like, you know, you don't know who you're dealing with. So I'm always like nervous about that, because it's like just one shot.
Yeah. And so on that subject you mentioned, Rabia, we were just researching this and Jen found it in the transcript. This juror who became ill at the end of trial, and it appears, Jen, from what you found, is this juror was ill. The judge talked to her. She didn't want to leave the case, but when the judge went back to the courtroom and told both parties, this juror is sick, it might take a while for her symptoms to clear up, do you assent to this juror being replaced? Both the prosecution and defense, without further exploration or question or bringing the juror in, agreed. Right, Jen, is that a fair characterization of what you saw on the record?
Yes, with the exception of, I don't think they note in the record that she didn't want to be replaced. Uh-huh. So we know that.
True. We know
through
it,
talking with her.
Yeah.
But that was not communicated on the record anyways.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like she can't walk. You know, she's, I think it's maybe the flu. This could be a few days. We've got 4 alternates. Are you okay with us putting in one?
And my question is, either Jen or Rabia, Do we have voir dire, the jury selection process, and do we yeah. have a sense of?
Oh, we do.
Yeah.
So, what did this juror say during voir dire that might be insightful? If the defense had inquired further to say, "Oh no, we want this juror still on," what do we know about her voir dire?
I have to go back and look.
Yeah, Jen
Sorry,
would know that.
I did read through it, and nothing like hugely stood out to me. I think she might have been one of the ones that was questioning death penalty, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah, she was against the death penalty.
Defense is nuts then. That's a swing you miss. If it's one of the few jurors in a death qualified jury case who had reservations at the death penalty, you are not letting go of that juror.
Yeah.
No way.
So here, okay, I'm going to read a passage from a recent email she sent me. She said a week after she was dismissed from the jury, she saw this same prosecutor at the Federal Grill restaurant and bar in downtown Allentown. And he came up to her and said, "I never thought you'd be a bleeding heart liberal." Now, first of all, how do you know?
How against do you the death know? Penalty.
Well, yeah.
A reservation.
And so she said, "It stood out to me that he realized I was not going to convict, which was upsetting. Perhaps the statement was due to my voir dire or maybe my facial expressions during the hearings." And she says, if he realized I likely wasn't going to convict, why didn't the defense realize it too and object when the judge asked if anyone had any objections replacing me?
And that's, I mean, in our Willie Vesey series, we had on Jules Epstein from Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. He teaches at Temple, speaking about death qualified juries in Pennsylvania and how likely they are to convict. And so, yeah, Rabia, to that point, just the defense knowing that she had some qualms about the death penalty, you do not let go of that juror unless you absolutely have to.
You know, look, we do have the transcript. Transcripts are also always different than hearing how things play out. But the transcript in the transcript is very brief. The judge is like, "Any objection? All right, let's move on." But I don't know. Maybe it wasn't that. Maybe he really gave time. Now, she also says this. She says that she got to the bathroom. Somebody went and told the judge. The judge came to her. And the judge came and she was too sick, but he was asking there were two other jurors were there in the bathroom about what happened. And then he goes, they're like, she got really sick all of a sudden, right after lunch. They had lunch and then she got really sick. And then he said that I have to talk to the attorneys about whether or not to wait out her illness. And that's all she remembered.
Right.
But she had no idea that she was going to be removed from the jury and she didn't want to be.
Right. As we were discussing, Rabia, judge can still remove her as long as the parties agree. And so that's what happened. But yeah, I do not understand at all the defense.
That's an ineffective assistance issue, but it's right too late
now. I mean, it's ineffective assistance, but it's not going to be strong enough to say, oh, they knew she had qualms about the death penalty. They should have kept her on. That's not going to be a winning issue. But just speaking practically, that's absolutely not a call the defense should have made.
It does go to the point that Margaret made and also Tammy have made is that they didn't feel like these attorneys were competent in representing her.
Right. And really, they should have asked for her feedback at that point about whether she was comfortable with that juror being dismissed.
Yeah.
All right. I have one final question that I wanted to address and then we can wrap up unless either of you want to suggest anything else. Mm-hmm. This is from Dean Carpenter. What if Walter Trotman is lying? He is also someone familiar with the crime scene. He is inserting himself into the case. My question is, why would Walter Trotman lie on the day of seeing this before anyone knew anything was amiss? That's my take, is I don't see him lying, but I don't know what you two think about Walter Trotman.
Okay. You know, I looked at this question and I thought about it. Mm-hmm. Could Trotman have lied and said, "Well, I saw this happen on December 15th and I made a report"? He could have, I guess, because there's no actual evidence of him making the... He says he made phone calls. They should have been able to get like recordings from dispatch. Nobody looked into it. He probably wouldn't have been able to access it himself either. I mean, like the police would have to have gotten that. But the fact that he keeps asserting this means he's telling the police, go look for these reports, right?
Right.
And he says he went to the barracks four times, number one. Then afterwards, years later, he gave a deposition. He swore under oath. If you look at his like, you know, like who he was as a human being, like he was a veteran. He had, you know, like this is not somebody who would like, he didn't have any, as far as any mental illness. He didn't have a history of like there was no reason for him to do it is the weird thing. And so he could have easily been proven false by them saying, "Well, we've pulled all the dispatch calls from that day. You didn't make a single call." Right. And they didn't do that. And so I don't think he's lying. I don't think he's inserting himself in the case. Whether or not he saw, you know, Andy and Joe that day, we don't know. But I don't think he's making it up.
And Jen, what about you? I mean, maybe he's mistaken, as Robbie has said, but any thought in your mind, Jen, that Walter Trautman is lying in this case?
Yeah. I didn't get the impression, but I also, listening to the question, I'm hearing it maybe asked a slightly different way. He's also someone familiar with the crime scene. Is Dean asking if maybe Walter Trautman was involved and thus is like, does he have a connection? You know what I mean? Like, from a totally different angle. And if that's the case, I haven't seen any evidence like that he was, you know, near the crime scene. If you're referring to the one in Heidelberg Township, no. I haven't seen any evidence pointing to him or ever being looked at as a suspect or anything like that.
There's no evidence that he was familiar with the crime scene or the Katrinax or their house or any of it.
All right. And so as we wrap up this season of Undisclosed, the official episodes, at least, Jen, any final thoughts about Patty Rohr and her case?
Oh, not good at summing things up. I'm going to be thinking about and working on this one for the foreseeable future. So, yeah.
And Robbie, how about you? Any closing thoughts you have about Patty and her case?
My closing thoughts are just, you know, right now I feel quite distracted by the prosecutor who is continuing to insert himself into the case, which makes me also wonder why. But I don't, our listeners see it. So many people see it. So much was unfair to Patty in this case. And I feel very deeply personally. I mean, I have cried over this case because you've got Joe and her baby. She's a young woman with a newborn baby. And then you've got Patty. It's like two mothers and two children. I mean, it's a lot of lives destroyed in this. And it's a devastating case for everybody around. And so, but you know, by the way, a couple of things I want to mention before we wrap up. Number one is that there is going to be a crowdsource effort to help Patty hire a federal attorney to do her federal habeas. And we also are finally able, after 10 years, Colin, able to receive ourselves tax deductible donations for the work that we do. And it's important to share this now because I want people to understand that, and I've said this before, we don't charge our defendants, obviously. They cannot pay for anything. It doesn't matter if it's documents. It doesn't matter if it's... And so much of the work, by the way, Jen has done has been uncompensated, okay? And we basically just kind of get by. We barely get by. We are not getting rich off this. Colin's got another job. Like, we just get by on this work. You know, we just cover our production costs and get by. But in order for us to continue to get by, we do have to find another way to fund the work. And so we're able to finally collect. So if you want to make a tax deductible contribution, if you want to, if you have like a company that makes, you know, we've had a couple organizations reach out, foundations. We're also eligible for grants now, all these things. All you have to do is go to our website, which is undisclosedpod.com. And it says, there's a link that says support us. And you can go there and you can either make a monthly contribution or you can make a one-time contribution. And that will help us to continue our working on this and working in other ways. But there is a team that's come together to help Patty's advocacy, both locally and more broadly. And we will be part of it.
Right. Well, thanks so much, Jen. Thanks so much, Robbie. And thanks so much to our listeners for following us this season of Undisclosed. And Robbie, what can the listeners expect in the coming weeks in Undisclosed?
I don't even know. No, I'm still thinking about this case.
Yeah.
Well, we've got interviews with some really interesting folks coming up. I know that. And we're going to be going back to our unfiltered episodes. If you guys have been missing Meetle Thelhan, we'll get back to kind of what's happening in the news as we prepare for the fall season, which is actually Colin's season, and he is killing it because he's already started scripting, right, Colin?
Yeah, listeners, is this telling Rabia? We premiere early October. I have scripted and pulled the audio clips for episode one. I'm just wrapping up episode two, so I'm hoping before my school year starts to have a nice little build up. So
it's going to be it's a really interesting case. It's
very interesting case, a lot of alternate suspects, multiple defendants, and a lot of questions out there about whether...
And this case got a lot of media scrutiny, too.
Media scrutiny.
Yeah,
so this is
it's a good one.
Something I look forward to presenting to all of you on Undisclosed starting in October.
All right. Colin, thank you for being our addendum host.
Yeah.
No this whole season. And thank you guys. And you know what? Listen, there are still more questions, and we're going to be doing a bonus episode to address even more. And that's for the Patreon. But every so often, if there's stuff we need to, you know, maybe there's more conversations that happen between me and the former DA that we want to report on, and we'll come back where we find something new. There's hundreds of pages and documents more that still need to be responded. And, you know, so maybe we'll do an update episode later in the fall.
All right. Well, thanks so much, listeners. We will see you back next week.
Thank you. Thank you, Jen.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Rabia.
Bye, guys. If you want even more undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you gotta do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at Evidence Prof on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Methil Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.